Morning. Just to confirm, that was a reading from the book of Revelation, and it is the beginning of the fall, which does mean we're going to go through a series on the book of Revelation this fall. We actually had clapping in the first service. I thought, yeah. Thank you, Vance. I thought there were going to be like these moans, but people were really excited. And just to give you a sense of where we've been, the beginning of this year, we started by looking at the earthly ministry of Jesus. We looked at the Gospel of Matthew, and in the summer, we were looking at the post-resurrection ministry of Jesus and through the Holy Spirit in the book of Acts. And now we're going to look at the final ministry of Jesus in his second coming in the book of Revelation. So that's how this goes. Curious, how many of you have been through a series, or you've either studied yourself or you've been through a series on the book of Revelation? Just be curious. Wow, okay, so you guys can teach me a lot of things, hopefully. I kind of have, you know, that quote where, like, fools rush in, we're only angels, you know, we're angels. I kind of feel like the fool in that quote, going into something that's as awesome and overwhelming as the book of Revelation. And I just thought I'd start by saying there's a lot of reasons why going through Revelation on Sunday mornings is a really bad idea, okay? Obviously, it's a really confusing book. There's a lot of different views on it that creates a lot of controversy, and it might make sense. Let's avoid that. Let's stick with what we know. Let's stay out of that whole thing. Another good reason is sometimes it feels kind of irrelevant to daily life. Like, it's really interesting. It gives me some interesting thoughts about the future, but I don't think it has much to do with how I live my life today. And so there's some good reasons not to do it, so I thought I'd start and spend most of the day just answering the question, why? Why are we doing this? And why now? And I'll get to the why now throughout the morning. But ultimately, as I thought about this, the why came from considering seriously verse 3. Take a look at verse 3. Verse 3 says, "Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it." Ultimately, we're doing this because I am convinced that there is blessing for us if we spend time entering into the world of Revelation. And some of you know this. My final seminary class, this was 12 years ago, was on the book of Revelation. And it was by far my favorite class I ever took. And I can affirm personally the blessing that can come from studying this book. It impacted me. It challenged me. It inspired me. And so if what happened for me 12 years ago, if some of that can happen for us this fall, I would say this would be well worth doing, because there is blessing ahead for us. And just to speak into some of the issues I raised earlier, this is a confusing book. Okay, I'm just going to acknowledge that right away. And there's a lot of different views, but there's a lot that, wherever you come from, there's a lot that we can agree on. There's a lot of points of agreement, and I'm going to spend my time focusing primarily on those points of agreement. Big biblical themes, big theological issues that we can agree on. So practically speaking, those of you that know the book, chapters 1 through 5 are fairly straightforward, okay? So we're going to spend a lot of time in those chapters. Chapters 21 through 22 are fairly straightforward. People agree pretty much what's going on there. We'll spend a lot of time in those chapters. Chapters 6 through 20 get a little interesting, and that's where people get bogged down and where, you know, interpretations diverge. And so in those weeks, we'll try to stay a little bit more high level. We're not going to go verse by verse. I'm going to try to draw out some of the big picture themes that I think will be helpful to us. Does that make sense, what we're going to do? So that's how we're going to go after it. And just the other thing I want to say is our goal at the end of this, we're going to go through this fall and a little bit beyond the fall. Our goal is not so that we come out of this saying, "I get everything about Revelation. I've got Revelation figured out. I've got it nicely packaged in a nice little bow." That is not the goal of this series, okay? Great quote from G.K. Chesterton. He says this, "The poet only asks to get his head into the heavens. It's the logician who seeks to get the heavens into his head, and it's his head that splits." Okay? We're trying to be like the poet with Revelation. I want you to think of, like, when you go to a great place, like Yosemite Valley or the Grand Canyon, okay? Your goal is not to explore every nook and cranny and say, "I've got this place completely figured out," right? Your goal is just to enter into this world that is presented and be amazed and be filled with awe and wonder. And that is our goal in Revelation. We are not trying to get all of the revelation inside our heads. We are simply trying to get our heads inside the world of Revelation to see what Jesus has to offer us through this very unique book, okay? And to the second point that it's interesting but irrelevant, I won't try to prove this right now, but I think you will find as we study this that this book has incredible relevance to our daily lives. And I would just say right up front that John did not write this book simply to satisfy our curiosity about the future. Okay, he wrote this book to change the way we live today and every day. And I think that will be really apparent as we go through this together. Are you guys up for this? I'm still open to a vote on something else. If you have other suggestions. It's funny. I don't even feel like I've chosen Revelation. I feel like I've stopped resisting Revelation. I've had so many of you over the years say, when are we going to do a series on Revelation? And I've finally broken down and we're going to go for it, okay? And hopefully I'll explain why now over the course of this morning. So what I want to do today is just an introduction to Revelation. I want to ask two very basic questions. First, what's the context? What's the historical context of Revelation? And then secondly, what kind of a thing is Revelation? What kind of a thing are we dealing with in dealing with this book? So first, what's the context? What's the context in which this was written? Take a look at verse 9. Verse 9 says, I, John, I would argue that is the disciple John, right? The disciple whom Jesus loved, who wrote the Gospel of John and wrote the three letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. That's the John we're talking about. I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering, in the kingdom, and in patient endurance that are ours in Jesus. Notice those three realities. The suffering that's ours in Jesus, the kingdom that's ours in Jesus, and the patient endurance. Those three realities really are a good summary of the context of Revelation. So I want to talk about each of those three realities. So first, the suffering. This book is written in the context of first century, a context of suffering. And the Greek word for suffering is the word phlipsis. Okay? Not an easy word to say, phlipsis. It literally means pressure. So the verbal form means to press, to squeeze, or even to squash. So right now, I want you to take your two hands, okay? Do this with me, and rub them, squeeze them hard together, okay? Whatever's in between your two hands right now is experiencing phlipsis, pressure, okay? Being squeezed. And that is the context. You've got these seven churches that this letter is written to in Asia Minor. This is modern-day Turkey, towards the end of the first century, and they are experiencing the phlipsis, the pressure of trying to follow Jesus Christ in the context of the first century Roman Empire. And we'll talk more details as we go throughout the series, but just high level, the Roman Empire was not an easy place to be a Christian towards the end of the first century. Okay, the emperor cult was on the rise where Rome was increasingly forcing its citizens to acknowledge the emperor, the Caesar of that time, as a divine being. We think Domitian was the emperor at that time, and people were increasingly having to buy into the emperor cult. So it was as simple as you go to a local temple and you go into this little shrine, you take a little pinch of incense, you throw it on a fire, and you declare, Caesar is Lord. Do that, you get your little certificate, you're on your way. Not that hard to do for most first century people. They were polytheistic. They believed in many gods. Caesar's God, whatever, yeah. But for a Christian living in the first century, of course, there is only one Lord, right? The carpenter from Nazareth. And so a Christian could not do that token act of allegiance. They couldn't buy into that system. And so increasingly towards the end of the first century, they are experiencing pressure. And that pressure took one of two forms. One was just outright persecution, like the word says. So for instance, John himself is experiencing that. Where is John when he writes this? Take a look at verse 9. Patmos, right? Which was not really a holiday destination, you know, okay? He's in exile on the island of Patmos because he has been faithful to Jesus Christ. He's experiencing persecution. And some of these seven churches are experiencing outright persecution. We'll read in chapters 2 and 3 some of the examples. Some of them are being slandered. Some are under the threat of being imprisoned, and there's an example of some even people actually dying for their faith in Jesus Christ. So there's this outright persecution that's happening, and then for some of the churches, the pressure doesn't come in the form of outright persecution, but it's just, it's the pressure of the Roman Empire to fit in, to compromise, to not be all out for Jesus Christ, but to live a both and existence. And we'll see some of these churches are pretty comfortable, but they shouldn't be because they're selling out. They're not remaining as faithful to Jesus as they should. Okay, so you've either got this outright persecution or there's just this the squeeze of the culture to try to mold them into the Roman way of thinking. Now, let me just stop there for a second. Is that relevant to today's world? Yeah? Are we seeing those two forms of pressure today? Yes, right? Okay, right now, some Christians around the world are experiencing outright persecution. And we are all very aware of it right now in places like Iraq and Syria and China and Africa. Atrocious things are taking place towards people because they're Christians. And one of the reasons we're doing this now is because I think that we all here, that the persecuted church is more in front of our face than it's ever been because of what's going on in the news. And so I thought it would be good for us to do this now with those fellow believers in mind. What does it look like to walk through this book thinking of them and praying for them and being partners with them in this, you know, this pursuit of the gospel? And then the other way is just in the pressure of the culture. And most of us aren't experiencing outright persecution, but we are feeling the squeeze of the culture. And I would say more than ever, the culture is imposing on us its vision of the world, okay? Its set of values of what it says is what truth is, what beauty is, what being truly wealthy looks like, what sex is, what real significance looks like, increasingly enforcing its view of the world on us. And so we're increasingly being tempted to buy into that wholesale, to compromise, to live a both-and existence, to say, yeah, we're Christians, but in terms of our daily lives, in terms of the priorities that shape how we live life day to day, it's to buy in wholesale to what the culture is selling us. And so that's why we're doing this now. I think it's incredibly relevant. All right, so context, first word is phlipsis, suffering, persecution. Now, fortunately, that's only one side of the equation, because the other side, take a look at verse 9, is what? What's the second word? The kingdom, okay? The context is not just suffering that's ours in Jesus, but the kingdom that's ours in Jesus. And Revelation, if it's nothing else, it is a picture to us of God's coming kingdom, his kingdom that begun with Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection, and that will one day come in its fullness when Christ returns. And this is a picture of the kingdom. It is a picture for us of the king who is in control. And we're going to see a lot of images, right? A lot of imagery in Revelation. I would argue the dominant image is a throne. We just sang a song about the one seated on the throne. John gets a picture into heaven, and when he looks into heaven, the first thing he sees is a throne, and someone is sitting on it, which means someone is in control of the universe. Despite appearances, someone is in control of the universe. And this revelation is a picture of God as king and his coming kingdom and the fact that he is directing the details of our lives even when it doesn't feel like it. And he is directing the course of human history. He is not out of control. He's perfectly in control of what's going on. And one day he's going to set everything right. And it's a picture of that coming kingdom. And then in light of those two things, the suffering and the kingdom, finally, the context is this call to, what my translation says, patient endurance. In light of your suffering, in light of the squeeze, but in light of God's coming kingdom, the call is this, patient endurance. Stick with it. Stay faithful to Jesus, no matter what. No matter what, stay faithful. And for those who are going through persecution, that would have had a note of comfort to them and encouragement. I know what you're going through is hard. Stick with it. God is on the throne. He's in control. He's going to make everything right. And for those who are tempted to compromise, that would have a note of warning. Don't do it. You do not want to be on the wrong side of this battle. Stay by Jesus. Stay faithful to him no matter what. Okay, so that is the context, and really that's what Revelation is all about. We're into a group of people experiencing persecution, giving them a vision of the coming kingdom of God so that they can remain faithful to Jesus no matter what happens. Okay? That's the context. Now, the other question I have is, in some ways, even a more basic question than that. What kind of a thing is Revelation? What are we dealing with? I think every one of us in this room who's read this book would say, this feels a lot different than anything else I read, certainly in the New Testament. So what are we dealing with? What kind of a thing, what kind of literature is this? And our answer to that's going to impact how we understand what's going on here. So I want to make just two points, two very basic points about what this thing is. First one, let me direct you to verse 4. Take a look at verse 4. What does that look like? What kinds of things start like that that you know? What's that? A letter, right? First and foremost, Revelation is a letter. John to the, dear seven churches, sincerely John, okay? This is a letter. It's a letter written to seven churches in the province of Asia, modern-day Turkey, towards the end of the first century. If you look at verse 11, take a look at verse 11, you get to see these churches listed out. Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum and Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. They're ordered in the way that a mailman would arrive as he took a letter to these different provinces, these different cities. This might seem like a simple point, but first and foremost, Revelation is a letter written to a specific group of people, these seven churches. And my point being that John, when he writes this, he has these seven churches most in mind. So my assumption is this, when John writes this, he's not thinking about Christians living in America 2,000 years later. He's not writing thinking, I want to satisfy their curiosity about what the future is going to look like. Okay? He's writing as a pastor to seven churches that are really going through a hard time, to comfort them, to encourage them, to warn them. Okay? He's writing a letter like we would write any letter. And what that means is we need to understand the original context in which this is written. We need to understand what was going on in their lives because it's written first and foremost to them before it's written to us. And so one of the things that means in terms of how I'm going to approach this is this. We're going to see a lot of images in this book, right? A lot of wild images. And the question is, of course, what do they mean? What does this mean? And my approach is this. The first place we're going to go to answer what does that image mean is not going to be to our 21st century newspapers. That's not the first place we're going to go. We're not going to go, what does this mean? Okay, let's look at what's happening in our newspapers right now. That's what that must be. It must be that. That's not the first place we're going to go. And one of the problems with going there first is our newspapers keep changing every day and every year. So 20 years ago, our answer was going to be very different than it would be today, okay? So that's not the first place we're going to go. The first place we're going to go is actually back to the Old Testament because almost every image that is presented is an echo of some Old Testament image. And so we're going to want to know what was going on, how was that image used in the Old Testament. That's going to help us understand how it's being used now. And then secondly, where we're going to go is let's start with the original context. Let's understand what's going on in the first century so that when these seven churches see these images, we're asking, what would they think of? What would come to mind for them? That's where we're going to start. And maybe then we can ask questions, okay, what does this mean for us today? All that to say, I take seriously the fact that this is a letter written to a specific group of people like I would any other letter. Make sense? Yeah? Okay. So that's the first thing it is. It is a letter. And then the second thing it is, it's a bunch of things, but the two things that I want to focus on. Look at verse 3 again. Blessed is the one who reads the words of this, what? Prophecy. Yeah, this is obviously a prophecy. That's the other thing is, it's a letter, but it's also a prophetic book. Now let me ask you, what is prophecy all about? Or let me ask you, what is a prophet? We can think of Old Testament prophets like Moses was a prophet, Isaiah, Elijah, Daniel, Ezekiel. What is a prophet's primary role? Anybody want to take a crack at it? Say it again, Dan. To speak the word of God. Yes, that is it. A prophet is someone who says, "Thus saith the Lord," and then says something that God has given them to speak to his people. Sometimes that has to do with the future. And usually when we think of the word prophecy, we think of someone who tells the future. And that's certainly true of prophets. Sometimes they talk about the future. Revelation is going to be about the future. And sometimes what they have to say just deals with the present. I want to tell you some things that God wants to tell you right now. And usually they're saying something that is hidden to people. It's not obvious to people. Otherwise, they wouldn't need a prophet to come and say it, right? They're saying, "I want to make something that may be hidden, that may not be clear to you. I want to make it clear to you." Look at verse 1. It begins, the first word is this word, revelation. The Greek word is the word apocalypse, which we know. And that word literally means to uncover. Okay? It's to take something that is hidden and to uncover it so it's obvious. So, let me give you a practical image. You walk into your house, okay, and you smell something that smells pretty good coming from the kitchen. You can't quite figure out what it is. You walk over to the stove, there's a big hot pot, and you lift the cover off, and what you get is apocalypse. Okay? What was hidden is revealed. It's what was not quite plain has now been made plain. Or you're at a movie theater or a play, right? And you're sitting in your seats, you're waiting, and there's this big curtain up front. And then all of a sudden, the curtain is pulled back, and what was hidden is now revealed. Revelation. And that's what this book is. It's a prophecy that reveals what was hidden to us. And sometimes it reveals the unseen realities of the future. It certainly deals with the future. But it also deals with the unseen realities of the present. John's going to say, "Let me help you guys in the first century understand what's really going on behind the scenes of history. Let me pull back the curtains. Let me show you what's going on in heaven right now. You're living your lives and you're seeing the world from a certain way, but let me pull back the curtain and show you life through God's eyes." How many of you read the series This Present Darkness by Frank Peretti? Remember that series? So it's this book series that is about the spiritual warfare that's going on. And you get these images of angels and demons that are fighting out as human beings are just living their lives on earth. And who knows if it's perfectly accurate biblically, but what he did was he tried to pull back the curtain and say, "Let me show you what's really going on behind the scenes every day of your life." And that's what the revelation does for us. It pulls back the curtain on the future, and it pulls back the curtain on the present. It says, "Let me show you reality as it truly is through God's eyes, from the angle of heaven and from the angle of eternity." Now, my last main point is this. The way that the revelation, by the way, revelation, Mark's going to laugh at me, that revelation is a singular word, not a plural word. So the last book of the Bible is? Revelation, no S, okay? That's, I just got out my pet peeve. So the revelation, not revelations, it's all one revelation. Sorry, just had to do that. Mine has no S, so there it is. The way that revelation reveals truth is in a very unique way, right? And it's through these very powerful visual images that are given to us. And that's what we all think of when we think of Revelation. These images come to our minds. Some of them are beautiful and compelling. Some of them are grotesque. Some of them are terrifying. But it comes to us in the form of these powerful images. And I want to start this morning by just introducing you to some of the images that we're going to see. So if you would, you don't have to, okay? But if you would, will you close your eyes for just a second? And let me introduce you. I just want you to picture these images in your mind. These are some of the images we're presented with. We're presented with images of great good, images of Jesus himself. One later in chapter 1, picture this. One like the Son of Man. He's clothed in a white robe, the golden sash around his waist. His face is shining like the sun. His eyes are like blazing fire. Out of his mouth comes a double-edged sword. Or chapter 5. A picture of this little lamb in heaven. It looks like it's just been slaughtered. Its neck has been slit. There's blood. This innocent, helpless little lamb. And yet, everyone in heaven and earth is worshiping this little helpless lamb. Or chapter 19, another image of Jesus, the rider on the white horse, whose name is Faithful and True, who is wearing a robe dipped in blood, and on his side, his name is written King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he comes on this horse with this sword to strike the nations. These powerful images of Jesus. We get these powerful images of evil in Revelation, like this one. This red dragon with seven heads who is waiting. There's this woman who's about to give birth, and he's just waiting for her to give birth so he can devour this newborn baby. Terrifying image. Or this beast that's coming out of the sea. It's got a mouth like a lion. It's got 10 crowns on its head, and it's making war against God's people, and it's given authority over the entire earth. Or this other beast that's coming out of the earth, and it's got two horns that make it look like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. And it's able to perform signs and wonders, and it convinces people to worship the other beast. And it forces people to put its mark on their foreheads. We get these great images of God's people. Like my favorite, the bride of Christ, dressed in white, kept pure for her groom, waiting for the wedding supper of the Lamb. Contrast that with another woman, the whore of Babylon. And she's straddling the beast. And she's committed adulteries with all the kings of the earth. And she's got a cup and she's drunk. And what she's drunk on is the blood of the saints. We get images of judgment, earthquakes, blood-red moons, stars falling from the sky, locusts with stingers that feel like scorpions, plagues, pestilence, and of course, the lake of fire itself. And then we get these images of salvation. New heavens, new earth, this beautiful city coming down out of heaven onto earth. God finally dwelling with his people, wiping every tear from their eyes, and them ruling and reigning in a place that is shot through with the presence of God from corner to corner. Awesome, you can open your eyes. These awesome visual pictures. And I'm going to be arguing that at least some of these pictures are symbolic. Okay, they are not the reality, they're pointing us to a reality. So for instance, the lamb that I mentioned is a symbol for Jesus. Okay, Jesus is not actually a lamb, right? He's a person. The dragon, I'll be arguing, is a symbol for Satan. Well, Satan's not actually a dragon, right? He's a spiritual being. And the question I want to ask is, why? Why present it in this way? Especially when it's these images that create so much confusion with Revelation, right? This is what creates all the controversy and what do I understand, how to do this. Why do that? Why not just say, Jesus died on the cross and he's worshipped? Why not just say, Satan's a really bad and dangerous guy and you should stay away from him, okay? Why present it in the form of these powerful images? And here's what I want to suggest to you. It's because of this, that in giving us the revelation, Jesus is not just trying to engage our intellects. He's trying to engage our imaginations. Okay, he is engaging our intellects, but he's also trying to inspire our emotions, and he's trying to ignite our imaginations. And images have the power to do that like nothing else. Right, we say a picture is worth, right? A picture is worth 1,000 words. There's something more compelling than just saying Jesus died on the cross and he's worshipped. There's something compelling about seeing this little lamb who looks helpless and yet he is receiving all the worship in the world. There's something compelling about saying more than Satan's a bad guy and seeing this dragon, this red dragon, who's fierce and terrifying. And the other part is this. We don't just live according to the propositional truths that we say we believe. Okay, we don't just live according to that. We live by the images and the stories that impact us every day, right? And so what we need is a set of images that show us this is how the world really is. Let me show you the way your life is and the way the future is from God's perspective. Let me pull back the curtain so you can see things as they actually are. I want to give you a quote, and then I'll explain the quote. This was helpful for me. This is a scholar, Richard Bauckham. He says this, "Revelation's readers in the great cities of the province of Asia were constantly confronted with powerful images of the Roman vision of the world. Civic and religious architecture, statues, rituals, and festivals all provided powerful visual impressions of Roman imperial power and of the splendor of pagan religion." Okay, that's the original, audience's context. In this context, Revelation provides a set of Christian counter-images which impress on its readers a different vision of the world, how it looks from heaven. The visual power of the book affects a kind of purging of the Christian imagination, giving it an alternative vision of how the world is and one day will be. Okay? Every day, these Christians were confronted with the fact that Rome was in control. They saw architecture, they saw coins, they saw everything about them. They said, Caesar is Lord, Caesar is in control. And Revelation gave them, in their context, a set of opposite Christian images to say, no, God is in control. His kingdom is coming. He is working in your midst. And that's what they needed. And these images have the power to do that. And we, as Christians, 2,000 years later, we are constantly being confronted with images of a vision of reality, of what is true and what is important and what is valuable. And we also need a Christian set of images that show us this is the way the world really is and this is the way the world one day will be. And I was thinking, that's especially true for us because we live in this visual age where more than ever, we're bombarded with visual images, okay? I want to show you just a couple images right now. My point is not to critique or affirm the images other than just say images have a power over us. Here's a historical image, okay? This image and what it represents has forever shaped our understanding of the world, has it not? It's a very powerful image to us of the world that we're living in. I want to give a political one because the quote mentions a political one. Here's a political image we've all seen, okay? I find that to be a very compelling image as an image, and it is certainly presenting a picture. Now, whether you think the reality can, you know, line up with the image is a whole other thing, but it's an image with a message. Here's an image that we see regularly, of course. You probably don't see Ben Franklin that often, actually, on your dollar bills, but somewhat ironic that on the back of this image, it still says, "In God we trust," but this communicates a certain thing about reality. And there's other images that we see all the time. Here's an image, hard to see, because she's very thin, an image of what is beautiful today, right? It's a message, it's an image. This is what beauty is. An image of, this is America's couple, is it not? America's couple. A picture that we regularly see, but what it means to make it, right? What is it? I mean, this is like, this is it. You have arrived. This is it. And it's an image to us of what success looks like. Here's an image. I used to drive a BMW when I first got married. I inherited it from my wife. There's an image on this in the hood. What is that literally an image of? Airplane propeller, right? But with the image comes the promise of the ultimate driving machine, right? It's a message embedded in the image. And then there's images that we actively put in front. I mean, we're bombarded with this stuff. Again, I'm not critiquing the image. I'm just saying images have a power to communicate a message. Here's an image some of us put in front of ourselves a couple hours a day. And this image carries with it certain assumptions about relationships and about self-image and how to present ourselves to the world. Well, there's other ones, of course, with TV that we put in front of ourselves. There's a good one, right? Not just a still image, but a moving image, a story. Breaking Bad, of course. Here's one more, okay? Game of Thrones, pretty powerful image. So again, just trying to point out the power of image constantly we are being confronted with images that are telling us this is the way the world works. This is what's important. This is what's true. This is what is beautiful. This is what the good life looks like. And those can impact us. And the reality that I'm arguing for is this. Even if we say we believe a certain thing, if there are images that constantly grab our imagination and grab our hearts, affections, and attention, in the day-to-day, that's what's going to win out almost every single time when it comes to how I actually prioritize my life and my days and what I actually do with my time. If those things have grabbed our hearts and our imaginations, they're going to win out over what we say, this is what I believe. And so what we need is a set of Christian images that not only engage our intellect, but capture our imagination with the way the world really is and a way the world will be one day, so that we can be people whose vision of God is more dominant than the images we see every day, so that what we read in our Bibles feels more real to us than what we see every day in a newspaper or a magazine or television or internet or whatever. I want to put up a final passage here. Romans 12:2, we studied this last week, says this: do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Let me suggest that is what Revelation is all about. That's the purpose of Revelation, is that we would no longer be conformed to the pattern of this world, but we'd be transformed by the renewing of our minds, and I would argue also the renewing of our imaginations. So why are we doing this now? Because I think this. There are places in the world right now where Christians are experiencing some really tough times. And each of us in our own lives are experiencing some really tough times. But there's people out there that are really suffering, and they need to be encouraged and comforted. And there is no book that has more power to do that than the book of Revelation because of the way that it comes to us. And I would argue there are Christians out there who are feeling the squeeze of culture, and all of us can relate to this, and are being tempted to buy in to that, to say, yes, I'm a Christian, but in reality, I buy into the priorities and values that are presented to me every day. And what we need is to be woken up. And there is no book that has the power to do that like Revelation, to wake us up to reality, to even shock us at times into what the stakes are and what it is we're really dealing with and what is really going to happen in the future. There's a famous political cartoonist who would draw images of, you know, political things, and he said this. He said, my goal, some of you will recognize this quote, my goal in what I do is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And that is the purpose of Revelation. We're brought into this world so that where we're afflicted and where we're discouraged, we might be comfortable. And where we have grown comfortable for the wrong reasons, we might be afflicted. We might feel, we might wake up to what's really going on. And so that's my prayer as we start this journey. And that's what I'm inviting you to be open to, is be open to being comforted and be open to being afflicted. And if we do that together, I think we will find this will really be a blessed journey together. Let's pray. Well, Lord, today as we start this journey together in your word, I pray that you'd use this in our lives so that you might be the dominating vision of our lives, so that you might become more real to us than the things that are presented to us every day, and that we might see you through the dailiness of our lives. I pray particularly for those of us that are discouraged, that are worn down, and I pray, I also think of the Christians all over the world that find themselves in really troubling times. Would you bring comfort? Would you bring encouragement? Would you bring renewed passion and energy for this journey to stay faithful to you? And in those places where we have bought in wholesale to what someone's selling us that is not in line with your truth, use this. Wake us up. Don't let us be comfortable in that. Make us uncomfortable so that we could be faithful to you, glorify you. Ultimately, the prayer is, would you give us a clear vision of who you are and of your eternity so that we might live more faithfully in the present. I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. You have homework this week, okay? I would invite you to sit down at some point, give yourself about an hour, and read through the entire Revelation. Don't try to figure out what it means. Just enjoy the ride, okay? Read through the entire thing in one sitting and enter in to the world of Revelation. Who's going to return one day